Okay, let's dive into something powerful and unfortunately becoming more common. The devastating impact of severe storms, particularly tropical cyclones, on, well, on where people live. We've got a stack of fascinating source material here today. At the core is a research paper that took a really close look at the damage left by Cyclone Winston in Fiji back in 2016.
And Winston wasn't just a storm for Fiji, it was a monster, a Category 5. It made landfall with gusts over 300 kilometers per hour. Just massive. The scale of the damage was immense. One source highlights that it left about 15% of Fiji's population. That's over 130,000 people without homes.
130,000 people. That number alone tells you so much about vulnerability, doesn't it?
It really does.
And as these kinds of extreme weather events become more intense, partly due to climate change, the need to build differently, to build back better, or maybe build back safer becomes incredibly urgent.
Absolutely. So our deep dive today, using this research paper and some supplementary articles and brochures on building materials, was really about understanding the specific points of failure.
What actually breaks in houses when they're hit by these extreme winds?
Exactly. And seeing what the research suggested to fix those weaknesses, and then exploring some alternative building approaches discussed in the material.
To see what we can learn from Fiji's experience that's relevant anywhere facing these threats, you know?
Precisely.
Okay, so let's start by setting the scene with Cyclone Winston. The paper notes it was the most intense tropical cyclone ever recorded to make landfall in Fiji.
Yeah, it reached peak intensity, Category 5, right as it hit the main island of Viti Levu. The destruction was widespread, but communities in places like Ra Province were absolutely hammered.
And the research paper focuses there.
It does, yeah. Noting that a staggering 46% of houses there were completely destroyed.
46%.
And another 21% severely damaged. It's just devastating numbers.
And this isn't just a one-off event in the region, is it? The sources point to a concerning trend.
They do. Increasing intensity in South Pacific cyclones, and they link it to rising global temperatures.
Which makes that building back better principle even more critical.
Exactly. It isn't just about recovering from the last storm, but preparing for potentially stronger storms in the future. The Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction gets mentioned in the paper.
Right. As a sort of global push for this idea of building resilience into reconstruction.
That's the one.
So to build back better, you first have to understand why things fell apart. That's where the specific research study comes in, right? A team went into the field pretty soon after Winston, June 2016.
Yes. They focused their study on two villages in that really hard-hit Ra Province, Nokonoko and Nabutulu.
And why those two villages specifically? What made them useful for the study?
Well, they were chosen quite deliberately because they were close to the cyclone's eye, so they got the full Category 5 impact.
Okay.
And importantly, they hadn't recently experienced another major disaster or finished rebuilding from one. So this allowed the researchers to sort of isolate the damage caused purely by Winston.
Makes sense. And the housing types.
They were representative of major Fijian housing, although being rural meant, a higher proportion of traditional timber houses compared to maybe the national average.
Gotcha. So how did they actually gather the information on the ground? What methods did they use?
It was a multi-pronged approach, really. They did an initial rapid visual assessment, a reconnaissance walk.
Just getting eyes on the scene.
Yeah. Then extensive photography at the house level, drone footage for those aerial views showing the overall damage pattern,
Right, the bigger picture.
and detailed habitat mapping, analyzing damage relative to location and structure. But crucially, they also conducted interviews directly with homeowners.
Ah, getting those firsthand accounts, that must have been vital.
Absolutely. Hearing how the storm progressed, what people tried to do, what failed,
How did they choose who to interview?
They used a sampling method based on people's reconstruction status.
Yeah.
So they talked to people still in temporary shelters, those with makeshift repairs, and those who are partially or even fully rebuilt.
So they could understand failure modes even if the original damage was cleared away.
Exactly. It gave them a broader picture.
The paper also briefly mentions the social context, right? These Aitaki villages.
Yes, described as having strong community ties, a sort of collectivist society with traditions of risk sharing, contrasting maybe with more individualistic communities.
Interesting context. Okay, let's get into the core findings then. What broke and why? The paper categorized the houses they studied into three main types.
Right. Concrete houses, timber houses built basically on the ground or on a low plinth, and then timber houses built with raised flooring.
And in these rural study areas, timber was much more common.
Oh, yeah, significantly outnumbered concrete ones, maybe a 70-30 split in Okanoko, and then Nabutoli was all timber, I think.
Okay, let's start with the concrete houses. Typically concrete frames, block walls, timber roof, corrugated iron sheathing. Where were the main vulnerabilities there?
Well, the good news, relatively speaking, was that the walls often remained largely intact. That's important. The primary point of failure was the roof sheathing getting ripped off.
Just torn away by the wind.
Yeah. The researchers found that the thin corrugated iron sheets commonly used, around 0.37 millimeters thick, well, they'd just shear off under that extreme wind pressure.
And the way they were attached, the connections, that was also an issue.
Yes, definitely. Nails were frequently used, and rusting, you know, made it easier for them to pull through the sheets.
So the nails failed, the sheets tore.
Right. The paper noted that in houses repaired after the storm, they were already moving to thicker gauge iron, like 0.42 or even 0.55 millimeters.
A direct lesson learned there. Okay, so concrete walls held better, but roofs were weak, especially the thin sheathing and nail connections. Now, the timber houses, the picture sounds much worse for the ones built on the ground.
It was. Total collapse was tragically common for this type. In some cases, literally only the floor or the plinth it sat on was left standing.
Wow. Why such complete failure? What was the fundamental issue?
The core problem was really a fundamental lack of a robust structural frame and inadequate anchorage to the ground.
So not tied down properly, no strong skeleton.
Pretty much. These houses often relied on the stiffness of the wall boards themselves for structural integrity, and they used sparse, often short nail connections just between the wall boards and between the walls and the roof structure.
Not designed to handle those forces.
No, these weak connections just couldn't withstand the immense pushing and pulling forces of the wind. Positive pressure, negative suction, internal pressure. It's a failure pattern seen in other big hurricanes, like Hurricane Gilbert they mentioned.
So essentially it wasn't built as a connected system, more like bits just tacked together.
That's a good way to put it. The load paths, how the forces are meant to travel to the ground, they just weren't strong or continuous.
Okay. Now, what about the raised timber houses, the ones sitting a bit off the ground on posts? They failed differently.
They did. The paper said the substructure, so the post and the floor system, often survived relatively intact.
But everything above the floor was demolished.
Correct. The critical weakness here was the connection between that substructure that held up okay and the walls and roof above it. That connection point failed.
How? What was wrong with the connection?
Well, the researchers observed that walls were sometimes connected to floor beams with straps, but they were spaced way too far apart, maybe 2 meters or more. Just not enough strapping to transfer those heavy wind loads down effectively.
Not frequent enough. And nails were used there too?
Yes, jolt head nails, often spaced around 150 millimeters apart, connecting the wall panels to the floor structure. But under the wind forces, these nails simply pulled out.
So the whole top part just detached?
Leading to the superstructure basically detaching from the floor, yeah.
The paper also highlighted something interesting about damage to the flooring planks themselves, how that could make things worse.
Yes, that's an important point. It's like broken windows, which were also common. When floor planks get removed or damaged, it creates openings.
Letting the wind inside.
Exactly. And when wind gets inside the house through these openings, it builds up positive internal pressure. This pushes outwards on the walls and upwards on the roof,
adding even more stress to those connections.
Significantly increasing the stress on those already weak connections between the superstructure and substructure. This internal pressure effect isn't new. It's been noted in studies after other cyclones, like Hurricane Alicia.
So even non-structural damage, like a broken window or ripped up floorboards, can trigger a major structural failure.
Exactly. It fundamentally changes how the wind interacts with the building. And, you know, the paper also mentioned the impact of windborne debris.
Right. Things flying through the air.
Sometimes a house was destroyed simply because a piece of corrugated iron from a neighbor's roof flew into it and smashed through a wall that didn't have proper framing.
Just a cascade effect of failure. Okay, so the research painted a really clear picture of the vulnerabilities. Thin roofing, weak and sparse connections, especially nails, lack of proper framing in timber houses, and those internal pressure issues.
Yeah, pretty comprehensive.
So what did the researchers recommend based on these findings? What were the fixes?
Well, the recommendations focus mainly on technical improvements.
Oh.
For roofs, they suggested using that thicker gauge iron we mentioned, 0.42 or 0.55 millimeter.
And dealing with the rust?
Yes, ensuring it's properly rust-proofed or maintained. And critically, using screws instead of nails.
Nah, screws would be stronger.
Much stronger in pullout resistance. The paper referenced testing showing screws can have something like 6 times the pullout strength of nails. That's huge.
And they pointed to a successful example, didn't they?
Yes, the Coropita Village. It's a fascinating case. They built timber-framed houses using hundreds, maybe even 1,000 screws per house, plus significant amounts of strapping, like 14 coils per house.
Wow.
And those houses survived Winston with minimal damage. It's a powerful illustration of how much connections matter.
A real-world proof of concept? What about windows?
Simple fix there.
Yeah.
Install shutters. Prevent them breaking. Prevent that internal pressure buildup.
Makes sense. And for those vulnerable timber structures themselves?
The key is incorporating proper framing systems like a skeleton to resist those side-to-side wind forces and adding bracing.
Making the whole structure stiffer and stronger.
Exactly. And specifically, strengthening those critical connections between the floor structure and the walls above in the raised houses. Using adequate, closely spaced nails, or better yet, screws and door straps.
So technically, there are clear ways to make these buildings much more wind resistant.
Definitely. The engineering solutions are relatively well understood.
But the research paper also made it very clear that just knowing the technical fixes isn't enough, right? There are bigger systemic issues.
Absolutely. That's maybe the crux of the problem. The paper noted that Fiji actually has a national building code established back in 1990.
Okay, so there are rules on the books.
Yes, but first it was designed based on wind speeds typical of a Category 3 cyclone. Winston was a Cat 5. So the code itself was inadequate for that level of storm.
Outdated for the increasing intensity.
Right. But perhaps even more fundamentally, the code was primarily treated as an insurance requirement for urban and commercial buildings.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't mandatory or really enforced for the kind of rural housing we're talking about.
Which is exactly where most of the vulnerability lies.
Precisely. So the problem isn't just updating the wind speed requirements in the code, although that's needed. It's about getting the code adopted and, crucially, enforced at all in the rural areas where it's needed most.
And a major barrier to doing that is cost, isn't it? The paper points this out.
Oh, hugely. Upgrading buildings to be code compliant is expensive. They reference costs for retrofitting schools, and another study from the Philippines showing it could cost a significant chunk of a minimum monthly salary just to meet higher wind design standards.
Which can have unintended consequences.
Yeah, high upfront costs can unfortunately push people towards cheaper, less safe, informal construction methods. That was observed in Jamaica after Hurricane Gilbert.
So you need careful analysis, benefit cost analysis, cost modeling.
Exactly. To make sure the standards don't become prohibitive for the very people they're meant to protect.
Another huge challenge mentioned was the lack of technical expertise, the capacity gap.
Yes, the paper highlighted a severe shortage of trained engineers in Fiji. The number mentioned was something like only 18 registered engineers for potentially 10,000 households needing attention across the country back then.
That's a tiny number.
It is, and most rural builders learn informally. Through apprenticeship or family tradition, they might be skilled craftsmen, but maybe not versed in the latest engineering for wind resistance.
So capacity building is key.
Definitely. Targeted training programs for these village builders are needed, and also for the government staff who would eventually be responsible for inspections and enforcement. Plus, the code information itself needs to be simplified, made accessible.
Not just a dense technical document.
Right, something people actually doing the building can understand and use.
And finally, the paper suggested linking government aid for rebuilding to code compliance.
Yeah, using that post-disaster moment, the funding available, as leverage to ensure homes are genuinely being built back better, not just rebuilt the same way.
Okay, so that's the picture from the main research paper, the failures, the technical fixes, and those really significant systemic challenges. Now, some of our other sources introduce alternative materials and systems.
Yes, moving beyond the traditional timber and basic concrete block. One article specifically discussed the benefits of concrete, more generally, as a resilient material against various hazards, not just cyclones.
What kind of benefits?
Well, its ability to withstand high winds and driving rain, for instance. They mentioned a reinforced concrete home that stood strong when almost everything around it was flattened by Category 4 Hurricane Michael in Florida.
A stark example.
It also highlighted concrete's inherent fire resistance. It's non-combustible, transfers heat slowly. So that offers protection in fire hazard contexts, too.
And it touched on ICFs. Insulated concrete forms.
Yeah, briefly mentioning that ICFs are known for their ability to withstand extremely high winds, making them particularly relevant perhaps for tornado-prone areas. But the principle applies.
So the general point being, using stronger techniques up front for hazard mitigation, that's the key.
Right. It's about preventing damage in the first place, which can potentially save a lot of money over the lifetime of the building.
Which ties back nicely to that cost discussion, but looking at the longer term.
Exactly. And one of the brochures we look at presents a specific system, a modular concrete system called StackCell. It contrasts this directly with traditional timber construction.
Okay, what's the pitch for StackCell?
It describes this system as using interlocking solid concrete components, designed specifically for high resilience, built to international standards.
And how does it stack up against timber in their comparison?
Well, the brochure's comparison table is quite striking, especially on cyclone resistance. It rates traditional timber as only moderate to low.
Which aligns with what the Fiji research found.
It does. Whereas StackCell is rated as very high, and they say it's specifically certified for Category 5 winds over 300 kilometers.
Big difference. What else?
It also lists StackCell as fully watertight, compared to timber being susceptible to leaks, non-combustible versus timber being highly combustible. And it claims a significantly longer lifespan, potentially 100 plus years, compared to timber's estimated 20, 40 years.
Longer life, less worry about leaks or fire.
And they add benefits like much lower maintenance needs, minimal post-cyclone repair requirements, being pest-proof, which is a big issue for timber in the tropics.
Stalagmites rot.
Exactly. And potentially leading to lower insurance costs because the risk profile is so much lower. Overall, it presents a case for superior safety compared to traditional timber.
The brochure emphasized something called the monolithic advantage. What's that about?
Yes, that's their term for the idea that the system integrates walls, floor slabs, and roofs into a single continuous concrete structure.
So it's all locked together.
Right. They argue this dramatically enhances the overall structural integrity. It makes it much harder for the roof to be lifted off by wind suction, a key failure mode we saw.
And it probably helps with that internal pressure issue, too.
Exactly. Because the building envelope itself is much more robust and less prone to those catastrophic openings like windows breaking or walls failing.
Okay, sounds strong. But what about the cost? We keep coming back to cost being a barrier. How does the brochure address that?
It tackles it head on with a 100-year life cycle cost analysis. This is where the perspective really shifts.
How so? Is it cheaper up front?
No, actually. Their estimates suggest the initial cost for a unit is slightly higher for StackCell, around $180,000 NZD, compared to maybe $140,000 NZD for a similar size timber house in their example.
Okay, so more expensive to build initially.
But then they look at the long term. The analysis projects significantly lower annual maintenance costs for StackCell, maybe $500 NZD a year versus 4,000 NZD for timber.
That adds up over time.
It does. But the biggest difference comes from rebuilding after disasters. Over a 100-year period, they estimate a timber house might need 3 full rebuilds due to cyclones or degradation, costing something like $420,000.
3 rebuilds in a century.
Whereas they estimate StackCell might only need minor repairs over that same period, maybe totaling $10,000.
Wow, that's a staggering difference.
It is. So when you add it all up, initial cost, maintenance, repairs, rebuilds, the total projected 100-year cost for timber, in their example, comes out around $960,000 NZD.
Nearly $1 million.
Versus only about $240,000 NZD for StackCell.
So a potential saving of over $700,000 NZD over the century.
That's the claim. It completely flips the script on that initial cost concern, arguing that the long-term resilience leads to massive savings.
That's a compelling argument looking at the total cost of ownership, not just the sticker price. Did the brochure list other benefits for regions like the Pacific?
It did. Things like the potential to create local jobs and transfer skills through setting up local assembly yards for the components.
Building local capacity.
Right. And the system being scalable, usable for different building types beyond just homes like schools, clinics, community buildings. They argued it supports sustainable growth by reducing the need to constantly divert resources for rebuilding after disasters.
Freeing up funds for other development.
Exactly. Plus an environmental benefit through reduced deforestation compared to timber, and the potential for these strong concrete structures to serve as community shelters during cyclones.
Okay, so let's try and bring all this together from these different sources. We started with that stark reality, didn't we? How vulnerable traditional homes are in places like Fiji to extreme cyclones.
Yeah, seeing exactly what failed based on that detailed research into Cyclone Winston, the roofs, the connections, the lack of framing.
And we learned that the failures weren't just random. They pointed to specific technical weaknesses, sure, but also highlighted those really crucial systemic barriers.
Things like outdated or unenforced building codes, the sheer cost of building safely, and that severe lack of local technical expertise and capacity. Big hurdles.
And then we explored how alternative, potentially more resilient materials and systems, like the concrete one presented in the brochure, while they might cost more upfront,
they could offer superior protection and potentially massive cost savings over the long term, directly addressing some of those fundamental challenges around rebuild costs and safety that came up in the research paper.
What seems really clear from all this is that building resilience isn't just about picking the right material or, you know, using screws instead of nails.
No, it's much more complex.
Right.
It's about wrestling with how those technical solutions interact with these deeply embedded social, economic, and capacity challenges on the ground.
It's a complex problem, and it's faced globally, isn't it? Not just in Fiji. Whenever communities are exposed to hazards, you find similar issues.
Absolutely. The specifics change, but the interplay between technical fixes and socioeconomic realities is universal.
So, thinking about everything we've just unpacked from these sources, you know, the detailed structural failures in Fiji, the layers of barriers to building codes and enforcement identified by the researchers, and then that stark long-term cost-benefit picture for more resilient materials presented in the brochures, what do you think, for the listener, is the single biggest obstacle to truly building back better in these cyclone-prone regions? Is it really knowing how to build safely? Is it having the rules and actually enforcing them? Or is it simply having the means, the money, to afford the necessary changes? And maybe the toughest question, how do you even begin to tackle all three of those interconnected challenges at once?